Thanks so much. It's an honor to be here and truly to be here, not just at APHA, but on this panel, and to follow the unbelievably compelling presentation we just listened to. So I'm here to talk about the Minnesota Pandemic Ethics Project. I will start by saying that I have no conflicts to disclose, other than I do want to thank, this isn't a conflict, but I certainly want to acknowledge the sponsorship from the Minnesota Department of Health and the funding from the CDC. Our project, which encompassed more than 2 years, was to convene people together to recommend ethical frameworks for rationing health-related resources during a severe influenza pandemic. We used a case study approach looking at a range of resources likely to be scarce, preventive resources, primary care, and critical care. We, throughout the project, beginning, middle, and end, we wrestled with how Minnesota should be attending to socially vulnerable groups. We looked for this in the Lit and Plan review at the outset. We certainly brought it to and heard it volunteered from the public when we did our engagement activities. And it is a theme that runs all through both our preliminary and our final recommendations. And then I want to conclude with just an observation about how this project did impact H1N1 response in at least a small way, but a way that we're very proud of, even though H1N1 thankfully wasn't as severe as the kind of pandemic that we were imagining for purposes of this project. The whole project was a public engagement event. We began with a very diverse community panel that met monthly for nearly a year, and they were supported by a bunch of expert work groups, and then they developed preliminary recommendations that we took out to a broader public engagement process. The first bulletin alone encompassed about 100 people. Then we went into 100-person community forums and small discussion groups in 9 places around the state, looking for particular kinds of diversity, especially in the smaller groups, and we also took the opportunity to solicit written comments on the recommendations. In the project, and certainly everybody in this room knows that vulnerability to pandemic influenza can stem from many things. And we talk about vulnerability and social vulnerability, and really for purposes of this audience, what we're talking about, folks, is health disparities, okay? So it's the same thing. So it comes from heightened exposure and susceptibility to the flu, including underlying comorbidities that can impact susceptibility, from poor access to healthcare resources, even in the best of times, much less in crisis times, from an inability to stockpile resources to help one be resilient, and just overall poor resiliency. And of course, as with all things, that when we talk about health disparities, we understand that compounded vulnerabilities heighten risk. And so it can heighten risk both in contracting the flu and in suffering serious complications. So what we heard throughout our process were many things, starting with simply include and empower people, take care in the planning process and in the response process, and take care not to compound stigma, divisiveness, and distrust. As I'll say a little more in a minute, that's actually not easy to do when you're also trying to say, but you really need it, so come on in. We need to define critical infrastructures with care and prioritize workers on whom vulnerable people rely on for life-saving services. The thing that I recall with just tremendous poignancy was when we were at the Courage Center, which is a large organization that serves people with a range of disabilities. A person with obvious, very profound physical disabilities said, when given the choice to vaccinate myself or my personal care attendant, every time I'm going to choose my PCA, every time, because I may die from the flu, I will die if my PCA isn't there to take care of me. That said, don't over or under prioritize key workers. It's a tough balance. So protect those on whom society and vulnerable populations rely, but at the same time, you got to get resources to the public itself. And be accountable for deciding who counts as being critical. We also talked a lot about barriers. So as we were talking about, you know, how should things be rationed, one of the natural next things to think about is, well, how are we going to get access to stuff even if we're prioritized for it, right? So how do we remove those barriers? Just massive, rich information. And so just a few little snippets. Use mobile units or sites near mass transportation lines to distribute resources. Don't just automatically assume it'll be at your local public health clinic. If you've got a place, you know, 4 blocks over and 5 blocks up that is right on the metro line or the bus line, for example. Allow people in wheelchairs to receive resources at their homes or in sites that work for them. Wheelchairs and crowds don't mix very well. Lift Medicaid restrictions so recipients can stockpile basic resources, including their drugs, and credibly assure that immigration authorities won't be present where health care and public health services are delivered. It's not enough to say, oh, don't worry, ICE is not going to come. You need to have messages from the community itself saying, don't worry, ICE isn't going to come. So our recommendations took the form of ethical frameworks. These are decision-making tools, not a rigid algorithm. And they start out at a very high level of generality to steward scarce resources to promote three equally important ethical objectives: reducing mortality and morbidity, both from the flu and from the potential of collapsed infrastructures, protecting safety and order, and striving for fairness. By fairness, we're talking about certain specific things. We're talking about it's fair to prioritize those who are at greater risk. It's fair to make and required to make reasonable efforts to remove barriers. But it's also, fairness also requires rejecting certain kinds of discriminatory strategies. It's fair to say thank you and reciprocate to groups that are taking high risk in service of others. And when everything else is equal, try to fairly distribute by being random. Most of our frameworks have a couple of tracks, one track for workers, one track for the general public, and several tiers, you know, so you start up in the top tier, and when they're taken care of, you move to the next one. And vulnerable folks, vulnerable populations, populations suffering health disparities are attended to in both tracks, because to the extent that the workers on whom they rely are prioritized in track A, they receive some protection, and to the extent that they themselves receive resources in track B, they receive protection. I already talked about proactive planning and reducing financial and social geographic barriers. It's also important to expand data infrastructure, because in order to prioritize according to risk, you got to know who's at risk. And the more severe the pandemic, the more difficult it will be to collect those data. So one of the unanswered questions that we have here is, what's your starting presumption about who's at risk? Normally, with flu, you start out by saying babies and elders are at risk. We learned in this last pandemic that the elders weren't at great risk. What's your starting presumption going to be? Our project also recommends to improve public communications. When infeasible to protect people directly, look for indirect protections around them, especially with vaccine and other prophylactic interventions. And track and adjust the distribution of scarce resources to make sure you're distributing appropriately. It's part of that accountability. Don't systematically deprioritize any group, lots of negatives there, but basically we don't want to leave anybody completely out. There are a number of criteria that were quite readily rejected. Quality of life is one we spent a long time on. Mainly, we just didn't want to fall down the slippery slope, so we said, don't even start. And this is going to be a little odd, but don't ration based on first come, first serve. Random is better if all the criteria are equal, if you can come up with a fair way to be random. First come, first serve tends to prioritize those who know how to get in the line. All of that said, our groups struggled with and ultimately said not to say that vulnerability alone should trump everything. There's a real sense that public health disasters aren't the right time to try to do everything that we can't do even in day-to-day life. And it's not necessarily the best way to protect vulnerable groups or Minnesotans generally. And it could result in greater marginalization and stigma. So there's a challenge then to prioritize in ways that don't make disparities worse and don't exacerbate stigma for populations that are already vulnerable. So in sum, one needs to attend and fairly identify and fairly attends to the needs of those who are vulnerable, but not necessarily be exclusively or primarily focused just on that. It's responding with rationing in a severe pandemic is a complicated endeavor, and it requires balancing and tugging and trying to do several good things at once. And balance ethical commitments to fairness with the commitments necessary to protect population health as a whole and critical infrastructures, and pursue common good in ways that are accountable, promote solidarity, and are fair. So now I would just want to tell you about this really cool thing that happened during H1N1 that the Minnesota Department of Health did in cooperation with a whole lot of private sector partners in the state. To implement one of the things that they heard loudly and clearly from the Ethics Project, which was remove barriers, including cost. So they instituted a 24-hour multi-language toll-free line for symptomatic people to call with questions about whether or not they should get an antiviral prescription. The nurses that staffed this line had authority to issue prescriptions under standing orders from the state's epidemiologist, who is also a physician. And the truly cool, so they had access to care right then. And the truly cool thing, for those of you familiar with logistical complexities of working with private insurance, is that after going through the algorithm, after deciding that somebody needed a prescription for an antiviral, and after determining whether or not if the person was uninsured or underinsured, they got a prescription, were told where to access a free drug from the state stockpile. For folks that were insured, they conference called in a claims representative from the insurer and filed a claim on the phone at that moment, and were directed where to go within the network for the pharmacy. And this was all done multiple languages, toll free. I just think it's amazing. And that was something that benefited everybody, and it started to have an impact in controlling the influx to the ERs. The trend towards special attention to socially vulnerable groups, Minnesota isn't alone in this. There's a tremendous amount of literature in it. There's attention in plans. And I would say that what's become clear is that it's not about whether to prioritize people who suffer health disparities or are socially vulnerable. It's how to do it. And it's to what extent, given that there are competing and worthy things that need to be done at the same time. And at the same time not do things that would actually harm folks by further stigmatizing or marginalizing them. Many folks and organizations to acknowledge, and I will say that while our report is not yet up on the web because the website's being created, I would just be thrilled if you emailed me and asked for a copy, and I will respond in reply. So is there time? 4 minutes for questions. Excellent. Yes.
I can certainly see the argument for not wanting to further stigmatize a vulnerable population, perhaps create a backlash against them. Mm-hmm. But couldn't you also argue that by ensuring that the vulnerable population are cared to first, it would create a momentum of the society as a whole to to put more resources into it. Isn't it often the case, yeah, you know, if it's the most privileged that get it, then as soon as they're taken care of, they're no longer interested?
So the question isn't it salutary to prioritize the most vulnerable among us? That will promote more stockpiling, more resources for everybody. And I have to say, I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. And I was actually surprised by the extent, particularly in the Hispanic and African American communities, but Hispanic in particular, perhaps because of what had just been happening with H1N1 in Mexico. We were doing our work at the same time as H1N1 had just been identified and then coextensive with the health reform town halls. That was interesting. And folks said, well, they reacted viscerally to the notion of being prioritized. They literally just went, well, don't do that. Oh my God. And we were surprised. And so I think it becomes a communications challenge. It becomes something where you say you're prioritizing according to risk at that point. And to be very, very clear how you do that, I don't think that we have figured out exactly how to mediate that, but that's certainly part of it. Our framework says prioritize according to risk. And of course, and it doesn't define who's going to be at risk, okay, any more than it doesn't assume pregnant women will be at risk. It just says whoever is at risk, okay? So we got a great big communication challenge. Yes?
Did you get the results back from that phone line that you call, like how many people generally call, that type of thing?
The question is, did we get the results back from the phone line? And I will say, I wasn't in charge of either thinking that brilliant thing up or implementing it or analyzing it. I'm just a fan. What I will tell you from my colleagues at the Department of Health is that initially they suffered from too much success. They were flooded with responses and they had delays as a result of responses. I wrote a letter to the editor and said, where would you rather wait for 6 hours, an ER or your couch? And and so, you know, they it was very successful, but I don't have the data. Yes. Yes, please.
I'm wondering, in your framework for risk only have to do with potential for contracting illness, or did it also have to do with the risk in terms of access of care? So I'm thinking of LAP communities, for example. Mm-hmm. I didn't see that earlier.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, this was short. The question is, how rich was the notion of risk? Did it include, obviously, risk of from the influenza, but also risk from lack of access? I would add risk of exposure to that. And I'd say it was a relatively rich notion of it. Primarily, what gets prioritized at the end of the day is risk associated with the disease itself and from collapsing infrastructures. But there is a lot of attention paid to removing barriers for LEP populations, for example, which is, you know, it calls for that. Doesn't exactly say how to do it because that wasn't our project, but it supports it. And then when he also attended to exposure risk. Is that it? We're in. Thank you very much. Thank you.